This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 28th. Good morning. Day before the exam. Well, the class day.
We have a bit of work to do today, including finishing talking about TCP and
reminding you that the homework that's due tonight can't be late and get credit because I'm going to post answers tomorrow. All right, any questions? No. All right. Then, let us proceed to the final information about TCP, and then we will do the exam review and talk about the sample exam if you have questions about that. So we've said that in the TCP header there's this field called the receive window, and that it is related to the concept of flow control, which is the mechanism to make sure that senders don't send more data than receivers can take, so that there aren't, essentially packets are not dropped at the receiver because they were received and couldn't be handled, that anything that arrives at the receiver, there's space for it in the buffer. So that's flow control, and this is a picture of it. And think about it a bit. It's not sort of obvious, but initially I think. But if you think about it a little bit, you'll see that the receiver sends this header field to the sender saying, "I have this much space currently in my buffer, and you must not send more data than that." So here's the tricky part about that. I just want you to think about this. Take a little figuring. Why does that mean at the time when the receiver sends it? Remember, the sender and receiver aren't able to look into each other's minds. They don't know each other's state except by the messages that are transmitted. So the receiver sends something that says, "I currently have this much space in my buffers. Don't send any more than that." Sometime later, the sender gets that message. Right? Things may have changed at the receiver by then. Okay? But the sender now obeys that message. And your job is to figure out sort of why it is that that's okay. Now, this isn't going to be on the exam, but it's an important point to think about in these distributed systems is how do you make sure that things are consistent between the receiver and the sender? And I'll just point out that although the information is old at the time that it arrives at the sender, the things that the sender has somehow taken into account by the sender. Right? Because the rule is not having got this message, you can send me that much more data. It's having got this message, you must make sure that you don't ever have that you don't have more data outstanding than that. And I guess the only thing that could go wrong with this is if the receiver lied and didn't actually have that much space. Right? But apart from that, everything should be okay. Okay, so that's flow control. Yes. So, next thing is connection management. Remember we said that a TCP connection must be established before you can actually start sending data on it. I just want to go over this very quickly and point out how this works using what's called, we're not going to go over the two-way handshake that fails, just want to show you the TCP three-way handshake.
This the
you go back and look at the slides and figure out why a two-way handshake doesn't work. But a three-way handshake is what TCP uses. It starts with a packet where it says, I want to talk. And the way you say that is you set that S bit. That's it. Remember the five or so bits in the header field. You set the S bit, which stands for synchronize, to one. You pick a sequence number, and you send it to the server. The server, if it's willing to talk to you, sends back a segment that has both the SYN bit and the ACK bit turned on. Notice that the ACK turned on in this one. Both the SYN bit and the ACK bit turned on. And it comes back, and then, and only then, the receiver is allowed to start sending data. And at this point, both the sender and the receiver have created data structures that represent the fact that they're talking. So the problems this avoids of doing this so-called three-way handshake is that there are certain sort of pathological cases where packets get reordered that lead to confusion otherwise, and that's what those two-way handshake slides were about. But this is the picture that happens for establishment. Expressed as a state machine, and then closing. There's sort of similar problems with closing about when packets get reordered, and so things are done carefully to make sure that everybody agrees that the connection really is closed, and we don't start reusing a connection that somebody thought was closed. So, not going to go into detail about that. That's sort of advanced distributed algorithms to understand why it has to be what it is, but look what happens. When we close, we send a packet with the F bit, which stands for finish, to the other side. And it can go either way. You can start on either side. You come back and say, okay, I got that. And you go into a state where you sort of wait for everything to settle down. And this is why, in your assignment, you have to be you're likely to run into situations where you've had a connection open and your program is finished and you try to run the program again and it says can't, that socket is already busy. And it's related to this sort of behavior here where it takes a while for the connection to really go away. Yeah.
So the sequence number is just arbitrarily chosen?
The initial sequence is arbitrary, randomly chosen, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Congestion control. This is what I really got to talk about. So, congestion is a property not of the receiver but of the network. Right? Should be obvious. And it occurs not because a single sender is sending too fast. Well, I suppose it could, but primarily it occurs because multiple senders are trying to use the network resources simultaneously, and their aggregate desire for resources is bigger than what the network can provide. And somehow or other, we have to be able to get the network, get the senders to slow down in that case. And what happens when there's congestion? Well, there are lost packets, of course, because buffers at the routers get full and then they get lost. And also, as the buffers at the routers get full, the time that it takes for the round trip time, when you send data and you get the acknowledgement back, goes up. So, and it's worse than that. So let's just take a look here at what happens when we have multiple users using this common resource and a single link that has a capacity of R bits per second. And what we would like to see is that as we increase the sending rate, and for some reason the Greek letter lambda is used to represent the sending rate commonly in network discussions, to represent data rate. So the data rate here is lambda n, how much load is being offered by each of the two senders.
And how much is arriving over here is lambda out, right? And again for the two receivers. And what we expect to see in the case that there's infinite buffers here is that no data is lost, right? But as the utilization, that is, remember utilization, the offered rate of the network, how much data traffic is it carrying relative to how much it's capable of carrying, measured as a fraction. As that utilization rate gets up close to 1, the queuing delays will go to infinity. Right? That's sort of the fundamental issue with congestion, is that when you offer load that is approximately the same as the capacity of the network, then you're going to get large queuing delays, and in the case of finite buffers, we'll start dropping packets. Okay? So that's, we're not losing any data in this case with infinite buffers, but the time that it takes to deliver any given packet is going to infinity. All right, already not good. What happens if we have finite buffers? Well, in that case, we can't let there be infinite packets, right? So we're going to have some amount of data that's going in here. Some are going to be dropped, and we're going to actually have to retransmit some data. So this lambda prime n is a bigger number than lambda n because it contains everything that lambda n had plus the retransmitted packets. Okay? So let's see what happens. These are animations, and I don't want to do that.
I want to. You can animate through them if you want, but here's what I want you to see. Lambda prime n, which is actually the amount of data that's being offered to the network. It's not all useful data because it contains retransmissions. When it gets to R over 2, we're already losing some data. So output side, data is not arriving. Right? So we're not at R over 2 yet. But if we keep going and increasing the data rate beyond R over 2, then so we can drive the thing up to actually producing R over 2 on the output. Because after all, everything that actually goes through the link is in this scenario good stuff, right? Because the assumption here was that the sender would only resend if it knew that the packet had been dropped, right? So anything that comes out of this link is good. Not everything that goes into this link is good. Okay. But, of course, the sender doesn't really know whether the packet was dropped or not. And maybe it got through, but the sender thought it didn't. And in that case, we're actually sending data through this link that is of no use at all. And ultimately, we end up with less good data delivered to the other end than what we wanted, right? So that's sort of what happens on a single link picture. So this notion of good put is the amount of data that arrives at the other end that's actually useful, and it may be less than what we put in because of things that are dropped and because of things that are duplicated. Right? So we're wasting resources.
Now, this is a more complicated scenario that I'm not going to go through, except to say that some really pathological stuff can happen when you have more than two senders and a more complicated network. Actually, even more than two senders and just a single congested link can cause pathological stuff, such as, if you're not careful, some senders may get all of the bandwidth and others get none. Even just over a single congested link, things get more complicated with more things. But there's another issue that hasn't occurred yet in this discussion, which is that suppose that I drop a packet here on the green, yellow, whatever it is. Suppose I drop a packet here because of congestion for the green. So let's look here. I drop a packet here for the green one. That means I wasted the upstream bandwidth here. Right? So there are lots of ways that congestion can sort of drive the network to be less useful than it ought to be. And what has been observed, and this actually occurred, and I think I mentioned this, in the late 1980s, we observed in the ARPANET that as the sending rate increased, the actual useful output decreased to the point that everybody was sending lots of data and essentially getting through. Right? That's pretty awful, right? The network had collapsed. It is what I call a congestion collapse. And really the only thing that was left to do was sort of turn things off and start over again. You could do that with the ARPANET with a few dozen nodes. You couldn't do that with the internet today. So as a result of that event, some smart people went off and figured out the congestion control algorithm that we're now going to talk about. Skip over that. And here's how it works. So we've talked about the receiver size that the sender receives from the receiver. The sender actually maintains a second window size called the congestion window. And what the sender does is it starts out with a guess as to how much data it can send without causing congestion. And it then as it experiences the network in the form of timeouts and duplicate acknowledgments, it actually fine-tunes its understanding of what the network can take. So the way it starts out is that we've got an initial guess, and as time goes by, we increase the congestion window. And then when congestion is detected, we cut it in half. Okay? So this is what's called the so-called additive increase, multiplicative decrease strategy for managing the congestion window. And what it means is that essentially the congestion window increases gradually, linearly, sort of by one every round trip time. But when you experience congestion, you cut it in half. So add one or two. So it goes up additively, and it goes down multiplicatively. And it turns out that the smart people who figured this out were even able to prove that if you didn't do something at least this aggressive about cutting the congestion window when congestion occurs, you would suffer the congestion collapse problem. Okay, so up we go, up until loss occurs, then down we go by half. Oops. Right. So that's the way the sender manages its congestion window. Yeah.
What's the time frame look like on that?
Okay. So actually we're gonna have another graph of that that will
Again, we'll often think about it, but if you think about how this works, the sending rate that the sender sends is approximately the congestion window over the round trip time bytes per second. You've got to go puzzle over that. And therefore, by manipulating this congestion window, we're actually manipulating the rate at which the sender sends. And that was the goal, right? Was to make senders slow down in the case of congestion.
Okay. So now there's one other aspect of this that's kind of useful to understand, and that is that suppose a sender comes online and picks a pretty big congestion window to start with. Then that sender is going to be able to blast out a whole lot of data, right? Because it's got a big congestion, it can sort of fill it up. And so it can sort of initially just say, here's all my data. Oh, network, right? So to overcome that, we also use this thing called TCP slow start sort of quickly ramps up to the initial congestion window, but not as quickly as just starting out with it. And the way it works is we send just one segment wait around trip time, then we send two wait around trip time, then send four. So this is not linear, right? This is doubling every time. And it's called slow start, which seems a little weird because you know, we said we had to do additive increase, multiplicative decrease, and here's a multiplicative increase. But we're only headed up toward the initial point of congestion here, and that turns out to be okay. So anyway, it's only slow relative to the way of just starting out with a big congestion window and dumping everything, right? Relative to additive increase, this is fast.
Funny names.
Okay, so when we detect loss by a timeout, we cut the congestion window all the way back to essentially one segment. When we see a loss indicated by duplicate acts, remember duplicate acts was the sort of fast recovery mode that would be faster than waiting for a timeout. When we see that, we cut the congestion window in half and then grow linearly. So this one's even more aggressive. It says cut it all the way back there. Things are bad.
And these names, TCP Reno and TCP Tahoe, are just different sort of versions of the algorithms that have been used at different times.
Okay, so here's what you were asking for. I think. So here's fast start, right? We're doubling every round trip time. See that? We go from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8. Okay? And then we get to sort of the initial guess for what the congestion window should be. And from that point on, we just increase by 1 each round trip time. And then when we suffer congestion due to a timeout, we come all the way back down to here. Back down to 1. I think I have a picture that shows what happens when there's duplicate acts. No, I guess not. I may have had a problem like this in the homework.
Yeah.
Problem about this. So I think it takes you... This. The TCP Reno version of this comes back down to just half, right? So So that's
congestion control. Why it works is, as I said, sort of a mathematical theorem that took some very smart people some time to figure out. And we're not going to do that theorem. There's a state machine for managing the congestion window, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So the behavior that you see, yeah.
On a previous slide, it said they always test their window to one.
What about that last slide?
This one.
Oh, okay. This is TCP.
Yep.
Skip over that guy. So if you think about this now,
you're going to see for a typical TCP connection where the sender is really trying to go as fast as the network can tolerate, what you'll see is that it is starting out at the maximum bandwidth over 2 and gradually working its way up to the point where congestion occurs, and then it will come back down and it will sort of sawtooth through there. And if you sort of ask what the average of this waveform is, it's 3/4 of the window size over the RTT. Alright, so
and so you can calculate that. Does it work fairly? It does, and this is actually quite amazing. So and this one we can get a sense of why it's fair from a very simple picture. So I think this is in the book, but it's not animated in the book, and it really is much more clear when it is animated.
So I've got 2 connections going on over a bottleneck link, right? And we've got the throughput of one of them, and we've got the throughput of the other one, and the possibilities are that we're somewhere in this space, right? Each of them is going at some rate that is less than R, right? And when they're sharing equally, we're at this point right here. All right? So let's see how regardless of where we start in this space, in this triangle, the TCP congestion control algorithm will drive us toward the equal sharing line. So here we go. We work our way. Both of them are increasing, and increasing by the same amount. So they sort of march along a line that looks like that as time goes by until congestion occurs. And let's see what happens when congestion occurs. Reduce the window by a factor of 2. Well, connection 1 was a much bigger number than connection 2. And so when I reduce it by a factor of 2, we don't come back to where we started, we come back to here. Alright? And then we do it again.
Alright?
We increase.
Congestion.
Reduce each of them by a factor of 2. And you see we're sort of gradually working this increasing line toward this equal line and getting equal sharing. And in fact, it works over multiple connections as well.
Okay. What happens if there's UDP in the picture? UDP doesn't have any congestion control. It doesn't pay attention to TCP's congestion control. And so one of the issues has been, and concerns with the internet over the last few years, is as people increasingly use UDP, are we going to potentially run into those congestion collapse situations that we saw with the ARPANET, because there's no congestion control? Or is UDP going to sort of take over and make TCP not functional anymore?
So far, so good. I think it's as the internet is built out with more and more capacity, and the the applications that use UDP sort of converge to a sort of stable set, you know, like we're doing VoIP and sorts of things. We're not in a position right now where there's this big new thing that's going to come along and make a whole lot of more UDP traffic. So far so good.
All right. So next we're going to do the network, but that will be after the exam. So now I want to do some clicks questions over this material. And warning, these are not simple, I don't think. Well, this one is. What is the purpose of the receive window size in a TCP segment? Gotta read the whole question, guys. Yeah. All right. Make sure the sending application does not overflow buffers in the receiver's implementation. Right? The field that comes back from the receiver to the sender. If the receive window size is smaller than the bandwidth delay product for a TCP connection, what does it mean? Well, this is related to something that was on the homework. Answer be C. No. Why? Because the whole point of the receive window size is to make sure that the sender doesn't overflow the receiver's buffers. And if it's working, that's fine. The sender may cause network congestion. No. Receive windows have really nothing to do with network congestion. So that only leaves A, but let's think about what A means. In order to make use of the full bandwidth of a link, you have to have the ability to have outstanding the bandwidth delay product's worth of bytes. And if the receive window is smaller than that, we know that the utilization of the link will also have to be. So you can come at it from the perspective of why the wrong answers are wrong or why the right answer is right, but do read all the answers. Okay, this is a lot of words. But the point is that we have a congestion window that's figured out by the sender, and we have a receive window that's then figured out by the receiver and sent to the sender. The question is, how is the sender supposed to take into the fact that it's got two different numbers?
that both limit what it's supposed to do. Is it supposed to essentially treat the minimum of those, the maximum of those, and what does it mean to treat the minimum or maximum? That's what this question is about. A lot of work. Going off the rails. Think about that. Think about what minimum and maximum mean, folks. The point of the receive window is that if the sender sends no more than that many bytes, it will not overflow the receiver's buffers. If the congestion window is bigger than that, do you think we should go ahead and send more bytes than the receive window? No. Right? The contract is I don't ever send any more bytes than the receive window. Similarly, the contract is I don't ever send any more bytes than the congestion window. So that means I need to take the minimum of those two things. Right? And so the right answer here is B.
Okay, and everybody changed their answer before I switched the question. Too bad, didn't get it. All right.
When a client initiates a TCP connection to a server, the three-way handshake is initiated by. Okay, so what this is? I talked about what it looks like at the protocol level. What does it look like at the operating system level, where we're sort of connecting the application to the TCP idea? Which system call actually causes that SYN packet, that first SYN packet, to be sent?
Okay, good.
Again, wrong answers, right answers.
How do we want to approach this?
We can rule out a couple of these very easily. Why do we rule out B and C?
What?
They're server-side system calls, right? Not done by the client at all, and it's the client who initiates the connection, so it better not be those. Which leaves us A or D. When I make a socket system call, have I even told the operating system the address of the server yet? No. That's part of the design.
Right. Good. Okay, that's it for the questions today. Let's quickly turn to calendar.
So, amazingly enough, the intro chapter actually has quite a lot of stuff in it, right? It's not just an introduction. It has all the stuff about what does sending rates mean, what does propagation delay mean, what are those units on those things, what's the speed of light, what's the speed of light in different media. I will tell you, you don't have to remember. I will not ask you to come up with that number. Bandwidth delay product is already in chapter 1. Of course, there are Flick's questions to look at for that. application layer.
Oh, that, those are chapter one questions. Client-server architecture, who has a fixed address, who contacts whom first, what is a stateless protocol, why is a stateless protocol a good thing, what are its weaknesses, persistent HTTP, what is that all about, why did we need it, that sort of thing. Some details about HTTP, right? What are the different requests? What are the responses? HTTP is a text-only protocol as far as the headers go. The data the data can be binary, but the headers are all text. How does mail work? You know, SMTP versus POP IMAP. What are the roles of those different protocols in delivering email, delivery mail, the caching, the idea of caching and how much effect it has, simple formula, but need to know that. Okay. All right, then socket programming. Which introduces the idea of reliable datagram protocol, reliable stream protocols, unreliable best effort datagram protocols. We talked about all that. We talked about the system calls, obviously, extensively. You need to know what they do. You need to know where they're used and what they, what order they're used in. That's clear. This just goes over those things. Ah, yes. Interpreting big Endian and little Endian numbers. Remember that? Don't forget that. Part of something to study. And this so-called dump format. I told you about the hex dump command that you can apply to sort of anything you want to and see what these what this format looks like. I will not ask you to sort of calculate numerical values for Indian and little Indian numbers, but I will ask you to write formulas in terms of powers of 16 or powers of 256, just like we did in the clicks questions. Okay. So I don't want you sort of calculating those powers of 256 and then multiplying. That's not necessary, but you do need to know how to interpret them to the level of a formula. And also what makes a number positive or negative in the two schemes. Yeah, same thing. Okay, more semantics of system calls, essentially. So you don't get away with just sort of memorizing things. You've got to sort of be able to connect them together in terms of what the behaviors of different things mean for the behaviors of other things. That's the goal. All right, so let's look at the sample exam. All right, somebody asked me last time about notes. You may have one 8.5 by 11 sheet of notes, both sides. It can be handwritten or typed. I don't care. Uh, Computers, phones, other electronics are not allowed, except may use it, but I don't see why you would need to use a calculator, but you know, some people are more confident with calculators, so nothing in the memory of the calculator or anything like that, just work on some calculators. And like I say, you shouldn't need it anyway. So, I may ask you sort of short, to write me a short couple of sentences explaining something. Sort of the critical thinking aspect of things.
So, we didn't talk about this, did we? We didn't talk about why TCP congestion control almost guarantees that at least some segments will be dropped in a TCP connection where the sender is trying to go as fast as possible. Why is that? Yeah. Because it has to sort of work its way up to the maximum to figure out where what the maximum is, and once it gets to the maximum, then there's congestion by definition, and it'll get cut back, and the cutting back occurs because of lost packets. All right, now we're asking you to go another step further. How do you resolve that with the observation that video and audio streaming applications, at least sometimes, do not suffer from dropped segments even when using TCP? Yeah?
It doesn't always the maximum.
They're not trying to reach the maximum, right? They have a fixed need that they need to go, and they will sort of settle into that. And, you know, if you observe Netflix or something, you'll see it sort of start out trying to run it at a sort of high-quality video. If it sees congestion, it slows down, right? It slows down. It chooses a different video encoding that requires less bandwidth because it really doesn't want to be in a position of losing the packets, right? That results in bad service. And indeed, you know, over some connections, things like Netflix will just not do very well at all. Propagation delay, transmission time, chapter one stuff. Remember utilization, the fraction of the length that's actually being used. And so don't get confused about utilization. The concept of utilization is how much of the bandwidth of the link is being used. Right? That figure that we looked at in chapter three that had L over R over L over R plus RTT, is sort of looking at what happens with the utilization of a TCP stream, right? When we only have one packet outstanding. Or a stop and wait protocol. So don't get confused about the concept of utilization in a particular scenario of stop and wait. They're going to be quite different. Yeah.
Two quick questions.
You bet.
Number one, are you going to be posting solutions to this since we don't have time to go through the rest of it as a class?
We'll see.
And then the second question, out of the chapters we've covered so far, which one do you think has the most material representing the exam?
I don't know. they should be roughly equal, right? I mean, chapter one had significant stuff. Chapter two, if there's one that has less, it would be two. But I wouldn't go into that. And then don't forget that we also used the other book to talk about the programming stuff. So that will be there too. Okay. If you have one last thing, I know some people have to go. If you have questions about this, you can't figure something out, feel free to email me. Okay. But working together in groups to study this would be great. Way better than me giving you solutions, I think. Unless you find that you can't figure it out. But, right.
I would bet that a group of two or three people could figure out everything on this exam without too much trouble. Okay, so I'll see you Friday. Yeah.
How close is this? There's no power of this deduction.
In terms of the timing of the question, it's pretty much everything. And as far as the problem, which very clearly means that we've talked about all on this exam, this would be a question. But the form of the question.
Yeah, no. I'm taking it as it comes.
So in terms of the actual system calls, we need to know the